keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side, keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our day, if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Right, it is that time you've all been waiting for, the 2019 predictions. Okay, so we're just going to go around the table. We have with us Simon Sayer of Deutsche Bank, Gary Buck of GKB Ventures, Simon Jones of TD Securities, and Alexei Ash of IHS Market. I'm just going to go around, and I'll go to you first, Gabby. What is your first prediction for 2019?
My first prediction is that the trade war between the US and China will continue to get worse, and the intensity between them will grow between them during 2019.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. I declare a trade war.
Yeah.
I think
that the animosity between the two is going to intensify.
Mm-hmm. And is that, I mean, what's that based on?
Well, it's based on my previous, last year's prediction about the acknowledgement of the importance and the impact that China is having. I think what we're going to see this year, 2019, is a reaction to that. I think that China will become more assertive in terms of holding on to its position. I think the US will want to push back, and as a result of that, there's going to be less agreement and more competition.
It's funny you should put it that way around, actually, that China should become more assertive about holding on to its position and the US will react. Because funnily enough, I'd put it the other way around. Not that it particularly matters, but you know, if anyone's losing their position, it is the US. And they are reacting to losing that position. And suddenly, you know, China's been doing this for some time. Let's not forget that. And suddenly the US has decided to be more assertive about the fact that it is losing its position. But in terms of the sentiment, I tend to agree, Gabby. There's not an easy resolution to this. And the trouble with something called a trade war is you instantly start to think about, well, who are the winners and losers? And that has a tendency to escalate.
Has the trade war been caused by personalities more than anything else? Because the US has been debating what China's been up to in terms of its economic support and political priorities it's putting in Africa, etc., and the way it uses its cash through the China Development Bank and China Exim Bank, etc., for 10, 15 years. I mean, this is not new. However, what is new is the vocality in the Twitter stories. So I'm wondering whether if there was a different regime in the US, would it be played down a little bit? There wouldn't be necessarily trade, you know, vocal trade wars. We're going to do this if you do that. It would be dealt with in a more statesman-like way.
Mm. What constitutes extra intensity? Is it an increase in the tariffs, as specific as that, or just a war of words?
I think that any agreements that they have for, the status quo that they've got today. Mm. Won't be maintained. And I think that the rhetoric that may be coming out of the US will be robustly defended by China. So the animosity between the two will get worse than get better. How you measure that, mm-hmm. that's hard to quantify, but I think that the friction between the two and the competition between the two will intensify.
China's political strength on the global stage has been assisted markedly by its economic strength and growing financial position. And over a period since Deng Xiaoping, it's had a massive growth for many years. Today, there is some stuttering. It has been for the last 5 years. It's been on the edge of 7. Is it 5? Is it 4? Is it 3% GDP growth? Now it's very, very big. There's no doubt about that. It's any increase is massive. relatively. But will the continued political position of China be sort of held back any way by any economic reduction?
So it was the argument that if maybe sort of China's not performing as well economically, they might not be as keen for a fight or as able for a fight. Simon Sayer, in our last episode, you sort of talked a little bit about One Belt, One Road and sort of that was moving to encourage more players internationally. Does that put pressure on the US, or does that actually mean the or is there a possibility that actually the initiative may sort of see a thawing of some of the rhetoric between the US and China specifically?
I suspect Belt and Road is more of an antagonism to the US China dispute at the moment rather than something that might lead to a thawing of the trade war. The interesting thing would be whether what is very much a US-China discussion and disagreement at the moment extends beyond the US and whether other countries get involved. And there isn't much sign of that at the moment. And what's happening with China affects the world order, not just the US. It's the US that's called out what China has done over the last few years in terms of running such a huge trade surplus. And growing its influence around the world. It's the US that has most of the problem with that, but it's something that affects the rest of the world as well. And I think what we see with Belt and Road, and in the last episode I talked about the way it's become more inclusive for European contractors and international involvement in Belt and Road, is in part a reaction of the Chinese, a recognition of the fact that it needs to become something more inclusive and more international. This isn't just about pushing out China. They describe it, by the way, as a two-way Belt and Road. It is quite hard sometimes to see the two-way nature. It looks very much like a one-way push out, but they always talk about it as a two-way thing. They're embracing investment into China and want incoming investment and infrastructure too. But the way they've included European business, European countries in that initiative, I think, is one of the way they have tried to soften their growing influence around the world. Whether they can reach some sort of agreement with the US along those lines remains to be seen. I agree with Simon Jones. I think it is very determined by characters and leaders. With in President Xi, China has something of a rock star politician at the moment. He's immensely popular at home. He can't really put a foot wrong. They've just elected him for another 4 years. And on the other hand, in the US, you have a very divisive character who has become quite voluble in playing to his support. And that is a factor for sure.
And with that in mind, what both are strong men, for want of a better phrase. Is this a trade war or is it a very public negotiation? And actually 2019 might bring sort of movement in that negotiation.
Well, they, the Chinese, have a very strong hand to play in the negotiation. They have huge deflationary benefits to the US in terms of the goods and services that they provide into the US, which helps to keep inflation down. And at the same time, and I don't know what the figure is, but they hold a significant portion of the US government debt. So their ability to have a bigger hand of cards when they're at the negotiation table, gives them the upper hand. It's like playing three-card brag and you've got seven cards in your hand. You're always going to have the better game and the better playing position on that table.
Yeah, although I guess you could argue that you have a president that built a career on making the most of being a large debtor. But it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. Simon Sayer, your first prediction for 2019.
Okay, so I think 2019 will see the end of the long credit cycle we've been in for the last 10 years plus. This is going not necessarily to lead to a crisis, but I think there will be almost a trend towards a recession. Could it tip into a crisis? Yes, it could. That's not my personal view. But the end of the credit cycle, for sure. And we're starting to see this happen. People are trying to work out, you know, and the art is always calling the end to a cycle and then moving accordingly. It hasn't been called yet. I think it will happen in 2019. I think the interesting thing for us in export finance is it's not necessarily a bad thing for our business because we know we are countercyclical. And if there's a general tightening of credit around the globe, including into emerging markets as well as developed markets, that actually can be quite a buoying influence for our business.
And risk aversion.
And risk aversion as well, yes. So, there'll be a tightening, and export finance will be a beneficiary of that.
Okay. Well, taking that first point on the tightening, Alexia, have you got any comment? Do you agree, or is that what you're seeing?
Yeah. The macro picture, if you look at, you know, where individual countries are going, but also where regions are going, I mean, to take the Eurozone as one of the biggest ones, it's clearly headed towards a slowdown. This is not surprising given the non-U-turn so far on Brexit, but also the Italian looming crisis, Italy already heading into a recession, Germany having seen negative growth quarter on quarter for the first time in the third quarter of 2018, Britain being unpredictable, although the best predictions being still a slowdown. The Eurozone is certainly seeing a slowdown, and you see that across different economies. If you look at just about, you know, we were set to talk about quite a few countries in this podcast, and as I was looking at the data for each of them, there are so few that look better for 2019 than they did for 2018. And that has two parts to it. It has to do with macroeconomic growth. It also has to do with the political instability. There are quite a few markets where you see more certainty around the political environment, but not necessarily more stability. And so that kind of pairs with what you were saying, Simon, about the opportunity for the ECA market, because if you have more risk aversion in traditional investment towards a more unstable environment, or at least a continually unstable environment, the ECA market has an opportunity to fill that gap.
Well, let's look at some of those countries specifically. I mean, in terms of sort of our discussions, I asked you to look at some of the key sort of borrower and exporter countries over the last last few years, according to our data. And so, you know, borrower countries that are big users of ECA data. Are you able to sort of go through a few of those and just to paint the picture of how that's looking?
Yeah. So maybe just to take one region, just to keep it focused. Let's look at Latin America. Let's look at three of the big stories of 2018 heading into 2019, those being Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, right? So if you first look at Brazil, here you have a country which in 2018 had a lot of people very worried about the election. Those fears came to fruition with the election of, I cannot believe I'm blanking on his name, I'm sorry.
Jair Bolsonaro.
There you go, Bolsonaro. Thank you very much. Critical tasks pushed into 2019 due to that uncertainty included things like reform to the pension and other things that will make the macroeconomic environment more stable. And the fact of the matter is, on the one hand, you have Bolsonaro, who is right-wing, who did get elected with that message, but doesn't control the government. So yes, there is a certain amount of certainty now that the election is over, but there's no more knowledge about how that's going to play out. And for the first 6 months of 2019, I think you're going to see a lot of uncertainty in the market as that starts to fall into place. Without some sort of reform in Brazil, it's going to go the way, I don't want to say it's going to be as dramatic as Argentina, but it could go that direction. And that's very scary for an economy the size of Brazil. So then if you move over to Argentina, here's a country where, you know, the government hasn't necessarily changed, but the IMF is critical to whether Argentina is going to be able to access enough money to keep its government going in any kind of stable way. This is not a new story for Argentina necessarily, but it's already it's entering into a recession in 2019 already. We're expecting negative growth of GDP by 2.2% for the 2019 forecast. Either the IMF steps in and saves it, and big austerity measures are already being put into place to make that happen, or you see some sort of influx from something like shale gas, which does have the opportunity to help out the Argentinian market. But again, this is a negative story. There's some amount of certainty to this story, but it's not a positive one for investment. And then finally, just to wrap up with Mexico, you have López Obrador, or OMLA, coming in on December the 1st. Here's a left-wing politician who's come in with promising that he won't do the traditional left-wing thing that people might be worried about, expropriating or revising contracts. But he does hold a majority in government. So reforms that he might want to be making that are going to be more towards the direction of his ideology are more likely to be pushed through. That especially is going to impact things like energy reform. So that investment environment is changing. Maybe it's not as much instability as the other two, but certainly it's one to watch for those opportunities for new types of investment.
And each of those markets are big ECA markets.
Yeah.
And
although, Gabby, you're right, but that you have to go back quite a long time to see them as big ECA markets. They have been in the past, but not recently. So the opportunities in those markets, I think, are really interesting.
Well, it's where you'll really see the lack of Exim as well, right?
For sure.
Because obviously they were huge Exim markets in the past. Yeah.
Were they?
Mexico in particular, but I don't think
Argentina and Brazil
were more European, more European looking. I follow Brazil very closely always, and actually very optimistic that the new president, he's not really everybody's cup of tea, right, for a number of personal beliefs and things he's stated openly, but he is the market friendly candidate. And what he's proposing in terms of the economy are the right things to do. You know, privatize public sector pensions. Reform public sector pensions and privatize the big state-owned companies. I mean, that's the big investment opportunity. And with that goes infrastructure and all the sort of things that we get excited about. So there's potentially quite an interesting market developing in Brazil.
I think the risk in Brazil is not that there isn't a potential for these kind of positive reforms to get introduced. The risk is he doesn't have the majority in government to push them through. And so you might have stagnation that just leads to quite an unstable economic environment persisting in Brazil as it has done for the last year or a bit.
Okay. And moving to sort of Simon Says' initial prediction, it seems that around the table and certainly from what you've evidenced on a country level, Alexia, as well, there is certainly a case that there is a sort of debt crisis potentially in 2019. But the second part of that was also that this will benefit export finance. Specifically in 2019, or is there likely to be a lag?
Really good question. And I think there could well be a lag. We have long lead times in our business, so I think that's a fair comment to make, whether we'll see the benefit in 2019 or whether it'll be subsequent years. But
be careful, you might lose a burger on it.
I don't want to be 12 months ahead of my time like Gabby, yeah. But look, you know, is the credit cycle going to turn in this year? Absolutely. And decisions will start to be taken in accordance with that. And we'll see the benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. Simon Jones, moving on. Your first prediction for 2019, please.
I'm going to go with a country one. I'm going to go with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia will ride the storm pretty quickly, and by the end of the year, 2019, a lot of things will be forgotten that have been very much in the agenda in the last quarter of 2018. You saw the investment forum that was led by MBS sort of splutter and fail, really, in the wake of the Khashoggi issue. And I think everyone's been thinking, what's going to happen in Saudi? Are they really going to be able to internationalize and diversify away from oil-based economy? And will there be a lack of investment? I think that was a valid debate, but I think it'll blow over. Only this week, 2 days ago, they issued $5 billion bond in the capital markets supported by four international banks who you might have thought wouldn't be there for them. They had a 20 billion appetite for that bond. They have got various reforms going on. The nature of, obviously, I'm talking way above my level, talking about how the government is going to be formed and who's going to be really in control. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to pan out. But I think the fears about Saudi drifting off are going to be unfounded. And they will be back and banks will be active. And I think investors will be active as well.
Out of interest, do you know at what level they have a budget, a balanced budget? Sorry, the question is, at what level does the oil price need to be for them to have a balanced budget?
I think I read this week that...
I thought it was quite high.
At $65, they've got a $400 billion deficit.
Okay, but the reason I ask is because I've got a prediction about oil price coming up. And that's interesting because one of us are going to lose a burger on this because if the figure is higher than, what's dollar today? A dollar Brent, a barrel. 62.
60, around 60, isn't it? Yeah.
So if the balanced budget for Saudi is 80, 90.
I thought 90.
Yeah. I thought it was high. Yeah. And my prediction is going to say something different from that. I think I'm going to challenge you on that.
Which means they need to attract investment, and which is why they will.
So that actually plays your argument. Yeah.
Well,
putting that in,
I'm talking about the political and international furore at the moment, and no one's going to invest in Saudi Arabia. I don't think that's going to happen. I think people will invest in Saudi Arabia, and they will be diversified.
So you think the pressure, potentially economic pressure on Saudi Arabia will force Saudi Arabia into a position where it's...
And the political situation of where they sit in Middle Eastern geopolitics do you
think that will be a result of a change in view of observers on Saudi or because of a change of attitude of the Saudis?
I think a mix. I think there's a resignation that, look what impact we can have when we get it wrong. Mm. So I think, there'll be a steadying of the ship.
Putting that in export finance terms, do you expect deals to be, Saudi Arabia was not a big borrower, if a borrower at all, in 2018. Do you expect it to be a borrower in 2019, or are we talking a little bit further?
We've been talking about an anticipation of Saudi Arabia increasing their export credit borrowing. I mean, they have been an export credit borrowing country for many, many years. And in the power sector, you've had billions going through. In the oil and gas sector, you've had billions going through. But in the context of the size of the economy, it's actually quite small. It was for the infrastructure spend, which is where the big domestic spend is, whether ECAs can be attached to that, and they've kind of avoided that and gone the bond route, the quick, easy route. They've taken bank loans, they've taken bonds. But at the end of the day, given the sheer capacity of what's required, I think ECA could well come back, not necessarily in a big way in 2019, but certainly moving forward into 20.
I think the question is whether the government and the debt management office, the Ministry of Finance, becomes a borrower, because the borrowings have traditionally been by Saudi Electric, by SABIC, by Aramco, and by some of the limited recourse projects that have been set up there. The government hasn't been a borrower for years, and there has been, speculation that might change, that they're interested in changing that. They definitely have been talking about it and discussing it and evaluating alternatives, and things in Saudi move at a fairly measured sort of pace. The decisions are taken very carefully, prudently. It's not something they've rushed into. We thought it might happen actually this 2018. It didn't. So I think it will happen. And I do think the Western world, whatever that means these days, but Europe, the US, and actually even China need Saudi to be a friendly environment for investment and for trade partnering. I think the reaction of Donald Trump to the whole Khashoggi affair was quite instructive, because I think he was the first world leader to say a bad thing's happened, but we desperately need Saudi because it needs jobs. It means jobs. Means jobs for our defense export sales. And actually two or three other world leaders towed the line on that one. And for once, he probably called that one absolutely bang on. You know, the rest of the world does need Saudi to be an investment-friendly market. So I think for that reason, and the fact that the Saudis themselves desperately need to do it, I would tend to agree. There'll have to be a sort of a rapprochement. And it'll require a bit of movement on both sides, because they can't afford to attract such negative press on a regular basis.
Okay. Gabby, you mentioned that you alluded to potentially a prediction on the oil price. Are you able to share that with us, please?
Yeah, it was going to be my third prediction, but I might as well bring it in now. I think that oil price will remain low, i.e. below $65 a barrel, and that will impact infrastructure demand for certain markets. So in many ways, countering Simon Jones's prediction, I think at $65, any major economy which is very dependent on oil exports will suffer in 2019.
Any thoughts about the dynamics of that, how it ends up at 65, you know, across the Venezuela, Russia, Saudi?
Yeah, I think the three dynamics divide that will keep that pressure low. I think the first is, you know, oil price is very heavily correlated to economic output. And we've already heard, you know, earlier, the outlook in terms of the world economy is going to be, I'm going to say best flat, but flat plus a little. So that's going to create a dampening effect on oil price. The second is that the OPEC, and I think the discipline of OPEC, is kind of wavering in terms of being able to control its output. And so therefore, there's going to be rogue countries who will just pump away as much as it can to create the budget surpluses that it's looking for. And I think the third is shale. I think shale acts as a natural damper to oil price. You know, it's a lot of the infrastructure has already been spent. If oil price goes up, they'll switch it back on. If oil price stays low, they'll keep the taps closed. So that, I think, will create a third downward pressure and keep the oil price around the $65 max. And that, I think, is going to have an impact, not just in places like the Middle East, but also in certain markets in Africa.
Yeah, I was going to bring up, if we play that out as a hypothetical and say, yeah, we're going to see low oil prices, where are you going to see the impact of that outside of the markets we've already discussed? And if you look at Nigeria, if you look at Angola, if you look at these other especially large African countries, very resource dependent, that have been trying to diversify, haven't quite gotten there yet, those are going to have a very hard time. And interestingly, this ties back to something we've already been talking about, which is who fills that gap? It's China, right? So maybe that those predictions reinforce each other to some extent. Yeah. But also, it also reinforces the political instability that we're already seeing on a tipping point in a lot of these places. You have a lot of these countries that have just had an election or up to have an election in 2019. A lot of those have switched parties. I'm sure we'll talk about that when we look at specific cases. But because of that, you know, there's an old joke about what's the best way to quickly start a protest. It's introduce subsidies, take away subsidies, right? And in a circumstance where you have something like oil price fluctuation, that's, you know, a key way to adjust for that, that governments aren't going to be able to control. So we might see not only political risk, but violent risk coming out of that kind of prediction if we take the hypothetical to be true for a second.
Mm. And that's, I mean, obviously you've referenced Africa specifically. Is that a wider prediction than that? Is it, do you expect that there could be unrest in some of the, you know, in the Middle East, for example, where there's other oil-rich nations?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Of course, 2011 looms large when you talk about unrest in the Middle East, and it will depend greatly on where you're looking at. A lot of countries where I think there's a lot of concern about that, the Gulf in particular, just hasn't seen evidence that that's going to be the case. Whereas other countries, especially in North Africa, where they did see a lot of unrest in 2011. There's been a lot of stability build up, looking particularly at Egypt. They've really come to I don't want to say good position, but a more stable position with the relationship between the government and the military that will guard against that type of unrest. But having said that, if you have a big destabilizer like low oil prices for governments that are, for states that are very dependent on oil prices to balance the budget, those protests won't be very far behind, I wouldn't think.
Okay. The financial crisis and sort of the aftermath of it actually saw a high oil price. And that high oil price continued for what was a high volume period for export finance. If you're talking about having potentially another crisis, maybe not as serious as that, hopefully, and you're also talking about maybe having an oil price that's much lower, if Gabby's prediction comes right, of $65, is that going to mean that some of these deals that were export finance deals come the last crisis wouldn't be able to happen this time, and actually export finance might not be quite as needed as it was last time?
You've got to look at it, though, that oil price at 65 or lower is really good for those countries that are dependent on importation of fuel. So they will benefit. What I'm saying is that my prediction for 2019 is that oil price will not go above $65 for the reasons I articulated earlier. And that, I think, will have a negative impact on those countries which are, as Alexia was saying, have been dependent on oil price in helping to balance their budget. And so in those markets which have been dependent on oil, I think that's going to be challenging in terms of infrastructure spend.
Yes.
And that's my prediction. All right.
Well, there are two dynamics here that work in different directions. And the first thing to say is I don't think any of us really realize the extent to which the export finance market is correlated to the price of oil.
Heavily.
First of all, heavily correlated. Yeah. That goes for trade and it goes for the export finance market. We're a subset of trade, of course. So high oil price, generally more volumes, bigger investment, countries are spending on infrastructure. That doesn't mean to say they're developing oil fields and things, because actually the oil majors and even the rich countries just buy stuff cash when the oil price is very high. But what they spend those royalties on and those revenues on is the infrastructure. But the force working in the other direction is that low oil price, lower revenues, of course, finance becomes more of an issue, particularly for long-term infrastructure spend on long-life assets. So what we saw working in the opposite direction was that countries which previously hadn't been borrowers in a low oil price environment become borrowers in quite a big way. And that includes large parts of the Middle East, of course. The last 4 or 5 years, we've seen the Emirates, we've seen Qatar, and potentially Saudi, as we were discussing earlier. Kuwait, of course, Bahrain, borrowing in a big way because they need to balance the books. So there's a that tends to smooth out the effect for the export finance market.
But you just said something there which is very important, balancing the books. So a lot of the debt that they're doing, like the bond issue that Simon Jones was mentioning earlier in Saudi, is a balance of payments funding, not an infrastructure spend funding. So I think I agree with you and I kind of disagree with you, Simon. I think the issue is that, yes, financing becomes more important when the oil price is low for a oil exporting country. But at the end of the day, financing is one aspect, but the other aspect is budget. And it's budget discipline, I think, is becoming much more relevant across the globe. And I think sovereigns will be saying to themselves, do we have the budget capacity to spend on this infrastructure, given that the oil price is now low? And I think that then has a knock-on effect in the way that they are viewed in the bond market.
If I could present a half-baked scenario here, just to offer a counter to some of the regions we've been talking about so far, and just to shift over to Latin America for a minute, because the elephant in the room for oil price is Venezuela. Right now, we already have a humanitarian crisis, but the question becomes, at steadily low oil prices, whether that becomes a refugee crisis. And if that becomes a refugee, we already are seeing this into Colombia, right? A huge number, I think going to be misquoted here maybe, but 1.5 million Venezuelans crossing the border. But so far, if it's been hard, generally people are staying in Venezuela. If it becomes untenable to stay in Venezuela, do we see 8 million or more than that leave, as some institutions are predicting? And the question there is, and this is where it becomes a half-baked scenario, what is the knock-on effect of that? Is it that the surrounding countries that suddenly have this flood of people who they're not ready for, don't have the infrastructure for, do they need financing to accommodate? These are not countries that are used to dealing with that kind of influx. You saw, if you think about the refugee crisis from North Africa into Europe, right? Here are countries who have the infrastructure to absorb those kind of numbers. What happens when you have countries that are not ready for that? Is it just a kind of civil unrest situation, or is it a situation where, because of that influx, you need infrastructure to be funded? I don't know. This is purely a thought exercise, but something to think about that's different from the Middle East or Africa situation.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, I mean, actually, well, you mentioned Venezuela. Also, sort of just earlier, sort of Simon mentioned Kuwait and Qatar, and I think you've done some exploration of what's happening in some of those countries and what you expect to happen over 2019. Do you think you could sort of update us on that a bit, Alexia, please?
Yeah, well, particularly, I would say Qatar is the more interesting case here, right? Going into 2018, there was probably still a question about whether Qatar was going to dig itself out of the hole set in front of it by the rest of the Gulf. Because, you know, being cut off from the region that surrounds you and essentially creating an island, especially when you're trying to invest in this massive infrastructure project that is the 2022 World Cup, is, you know, a big risk. And Qatar, probably by virtue of the fact that they have done an enormous amount of work to trade with other entities over the course of 2018, and also because they had a huge amount of foreign exchange reserves going into the blockade, have come out of it without too much risk. If you looked at, you know, the kind of week-on-week returns of the stock market, which is just one benchmark to see how Qatar is doing, you know, it's up 6% since the crisis began, right? And so for most of 2018, it was below where the crisis started, and now we're rising above that, which is just to say that people are investing in Qatar or Qatari companies. I was informed right before this podcast that Qatar is no longer quite the largest LNG exporter in the world, having been overtaken by Australia, but it's still a huge exporter of LNG. That hasn't changed. And as I mentioned before, there's an enormous amount of infrastructure development still happening in Qatar. A lot of that is, of course, funded already, but going into the 2022 World Cup, there is just an enormous amount of construction. And that is, of course, helping Qatar have strong economic growth as well. And in addition to that, because they've come out of this economic crisis fairly well, the political stability has remained, which was a risk at the beginning of 2018.
Okay, thank you.
The response of Qatar to the blockade has been quite extraordinary. They've managed it incredibly well, haven't they? And the interesting thing about Qatar is, unlike its immediate neighbors, they can actually afford to delay diversification for really quite some time, and arguably indefinitely, because they have so much gas, and the Qatari population is so small. I think there are 300,000 Qataris. There's a population of about 2.5 million people. But only 300,000 Qataris. They don't really need to have a diversified economy. They can rely on the gas they have for many, many, many years, and if necessary, give everybody a public sector job. Now, I'm not saying they would go to that extreme, but they are not under the same pressure as many of their neighbors are to diversify and find jobs for an emerging, educated, young population.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, they import an enormous amount of their labor. They're very happy to send them right back as soon as they don't need that labor anymore. And so they're not looking to build infrastructure to support that population, even when it's needed for a short amount of time. And in addition to that, they've been very inventive in making sure they keep themselves looking good on the world stage throughout the crisis. And I mean that in a business sense. So, for example, you know, Qatar Airways, the flagship airline, couldn't do a whole lot of flying because it couldn't go over its immediate neighbors. So they were lending out planes, right? You know, there were other big airlines who I probably shouldn't name, but you can certainly figure it out, who were taking those planes, repainting them temporarily, and using them, renting out from Qatar Airways while they couldn't meet the same kind of flight paths that they had had previously. And that has also, just talking about inventiveness, eventually come around to them being able to negotiate new flight paths that they can then once again fly their normal routes and with their hub in Doha. So, you know, that's just one way in which not just the government, but also the flagship kind of enterprises have been able to adapt and make sure that they still are able to do business despite being told that they can't.
And also that they've gone, I'm pointing out to Simon Jones. I remember, Simon, when we worked together, you were heavily involved with Qatargas and the LNG projects. And what was quite interesting at that point in time, and you can elaborate more, was how the Qataris then were always tapping all three markets at the same time. They were tapping the bank market, the bond market, and the ECA market. And it was just a diversification. They were always about that external perception of making sure that they were well known and well understood.
Sure, yeah. They've...
No, absolutely. And even the airline strategy was part of that. The airline was more about the internationalization of Qatar and getting it known around the world in the same way that Emirates was for Dubai and Etihad is for Abu Dhabi as well. Absolutely.
And you saw in 2018 the opening of a world-class art museum, which what is the point of that if not to attract attention from outsiders?
Mm. There's also a lot of competition between the GCC nations on that type of thing. The UAE and Saudi and Qatar all vying for top spot.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sun